Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Voice Aerobics Talking to You. I'm Mary Springuli. I'm a speech-language pathologist, and I'm your host. So June is Aphasia Awareness Month, and I'm happy this year, as I have in previous years, to dedicate today's podcast to the topic of aphasia. For those of you who are listening and are not familiar with the term, aphasia refers to a communication disorder that impairs a person's ability to process language or their ability to speak and understand others while leaving their intelligence intact. It's reported that over 2 million Americans suffer from aphasia, and while it's usually the result of a stroke, it can also occur in association with a traumatic brain injury or a brain tumor. I often think that the sudden onset of aphasia must be a little bit like suddenly finding yourself in a foreign country where you know what you want to say, but you're unable to speak the language, or the speakers are speaking too fast for you to understand. I can hardly speak about aphasia anymore without talking a little bit about my own personal experience when my mom suffered an unexpected stroke 4 years ago, and it resulted in a very severe expressive aphasia. And despite her apparent understanding, I remember those early weeks when she was unable to speak a word, and those days in the hospital were fraught with frustration, both hers and mine. 4 years later, I'm happy to say that my mom recovered well enough to go back to living in her own home and doing many of the things that she loves to do. I am also well aware, however, having been a speech pathologist for many years, that not many patients or many other patients don't recover their language to a near normal level. And so for many of those people who are left with aphasia, they can also feel very withdrawn. They can become withdrawn. They can feel left out of the things that they enjoyed doing before they suffered their stroke. And although speech and language therapy, of course, is very important early on and for sometimes months after an individual has acquired aphasia, today we're not going to focus too much on therapy, but rather we're going to focus more on really what happens after therapy, what the needs are, including community-based programs, and how they can really fill a gap for people and really serve as a bridge to help people with aphasia reconnect with and enjoy their lives again. So my guests today are Dr. Jackie Hinckley, who is the executive director of Voices of Hope for Aphasia, which is a program based here in Southwest Florida, that really strives to reconnect people living with aphasia with their lives through innovative programming, which we'll talk about this afternoon. Joining us will also be Dr. Audrey Holland. Dr. Holland really needs a little introduction among speech-language pathologists, as she's known for her work in the area of neurogenic communication disorders and the management of aphasia. Dr. Holland is a professor emeritus of speech, language, and hearing sciences at the University of Arizona. She maintains an active clinical role in rehabilitation of adults with aphasia and has published over 125 research articles, textbooks, and clinical tools. So welcome to both of you. I would just like to remind listeners that if you would like to call and ask a question, you can call in at 347-838-9137 and touch 1 on your phone keypad. You can also send an email to info@voiceaerobicsdvd.com or send a tweet at voiceaerobics using the hashtag aphasia awareness. All right, so again, welcome to both of my guests. And Dr. Hinckley, who I'll call Jackie from this point forward, let's start with you. Jackie, I know that you have spent many years of your career as a speech-language pathologist working directly with patients and also teaching students. So tell listeners a little bit about how you became drawn or interested in aphasia, and then what led you to your current position as executive director of Voices of Hope for Aphasia.
Well, Mary, first I want to start by thanking you for having me and Audrey on your podcast today and featuring aphasia awareness this month. I think without realizing it, I had an experience when I was about 18 years old, and I was in France with very little French. And I was living with a family. It was about my first day with them. And I stood in the hallway looking at them, wanting to tell them that I was going to go out and do something and come back fairly shortly. And I stood there for a long time realizing that I didn't have the words to convey that simple message. And I really didn't know what else to do. So in the end, I just sort of smiled and walked out. But I think later, as I got into college and I was interested in the brain and how the brain functions, that experience, along with similar things, personal experience, I think, led me to aphasia and the experience of knowing exactly what you want to say and just not having any idea exactly how to go about communicating it. Leading to my position now, I was very fortunate in the first several years of my career to be the program director at an intensive aphasia program at the University of Michigan, really for 10 years. And at that time, that was a residential program. And the experience of seeing what happens to people, not just during the therapy hour, but later in the evening or when they want to strike up a friendship or a conversation or how they're going to fill their time in the weekend, I think that made a huge impression on me in the early part of my career. And so putting that all together, I think it's probably, you know, I feel that I'm following in all those steps and all those things that happened before by becoming executive director of Voices of Hope for Aphasia, because what we're doing is trying to create programs and supports and an environment where people with aphasia are accepted and successful doing things that are normal life rather than just therapy. Not to say that therapy isn't important, as you emphasized, Mary, in your introduction, but it certainly is. But, you know, people are not going to spend their lives in therapy. So we have to put attention to what they are going to spend their lives doing. So I think that's really what led to me pursuing this now with Voices of Hope, and it's a real joy and a pleasure for me.
You mentioned two things I really want to pick up on. We'll talk in depth about one of them maybe a little bit later after we also bring Dr. Holland in on the discussion, but I mentioned, and you did as well, about this feeling of aphasia, or best we can understand it as maybe being lost in a foreign country, unable to speak. But you made, or I think it's important to make the point that for most persons, intelligence is not affected. I had a patient yesterday, a fairly new patient to me, who's a very smart man. He self-describes that way, and indeed he is. He's a healthcare professional, yet expressed to me, as so many other people have, my own mom did, this feeling of I'm so stupid, or I feel so stupid, and worrying that people perceive them that way because of the language impairment. I'm just wondering if you could maybe just elaborate on that a little bit and clarify again what's, I think, so important for people to understand.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yep, go ahead, Jackie.
Yes, it's so important for people to understand that being able to come up with words is not the same as being able to come up with ideas. So a lack of words is not equal to a lack of thoughts or a lack of ideas. And it's interesting to think about that because in our society, we do often equate words and how articulate someone is and what kind of words they use. I mean, we make judgments about people based on words and how people speak. Whether we intend to make those judgments or not, I think, you know, this is it's something we use to get impressions of other people. And so, unfortunately, that can, in some instances, work to the detriment of a person with aphasia, not just because the people around them may think that that person has some sort of a impairment of intelligence, which they don't, but the person themselves, as you're saying, Mary, may even think of themselves as not very smart. I've heard many patients say, "I'm not smart anymore," things like that, because they are not coming up with the words. And, you know, that's not really the case in aphasia. What I'm hoping as our world changes and we all use so many different ways to communicate, text and video and images and tweets and all kinds of things, that hopefully over time we will become more and more accepting of a whole range of ways of communicating, and that stigma that can be associated with a communication disability perhaps might change over time as well.
Dr. Holland, I would like to bring your voice into this discussion. So again, let me welcome Dr. Audrey Holland, and again, I'll shift to a more personal Audrey from this point forward. Again, welcome, and it's a great honor to have you. I was going to ask you to reflect a little bit about what you've seen as changes in your years of the profession, but I just would, before I do that, would like to stay with what we were talking about just for a moment. And I think one of the challenges, I guess I can speak for myself as a therapist certainly, is this notion of, is there a time when enough therapy already? You know, someone comes to, is referred, who is now many years post-stroke, but they and or a spouse is very desirous of and still having more therapy. And I think for a lot of speech-language therapists, they're uncomfortable. They don't really quite know how to respond. Do they continue to offer more therapy? And don't know how to really, again, help shift maybe to a different focus. I'm just wondering if you could comment on that a little bit. I know that's an area certainly that you have written about.
No, I don't think therapists should feel uncomfortable with that. By the way, before I start, I really want to thank you for inviting me to this. And I do want to express my incredible sympathy, the amount of it, with the state of Florida and the events of last Sunday. This has been reverberating across the country, and it certainly has reached Arizona. And I just want you to know that most positively we are feeling hopeful for you and hopeful for the state of Florida, and really share and offer condolences.
Thank you.
Actually, in terms of the question you asked, Mary, I don't really know that we should be too leery about working with people long post-stroke. I think we're changing our understanding of how change comes about in aphasia, and in fact are probably likely to move even direct work further away from hospital-based acute care and rehab down the road. And, of course, one of the strong ways for doing that is what I consider to be the biggest change that's come over our profession in a long time. And that's not just our profession, but it's sort of true of the healthcare system in general. The way person-centeredness is beginning really to improve service delivery across the spectrum. And I think that's largely a result of the ACA and we're going to be feeling more and more of that, that patients and families have a role in determining their future. And certainly a strong piece of this is directly related in the development and maintenance of aphasia centers and groups mm-hmm. and camps, programs like mm-hmm. Voices of Hope. What's happening in those programs is that community nurturance and enjoyment of them is really making a difference long-term in aphasia. My colleagues and I in Aphasia Bank have just published an article in the upcoming issue of Aphasiology, which is available online, looking at way down the road changes on the impairment of aphasia. Everyone who is in that study, and by far the majority of people in that study, attended aphasia groups and were part of an aphasia community. They weren't in individual therapy. They had the nurturance of aphasia programs that supported them. And I think as a surprise, certainly to me, was that that was reflected not only in a whole lot of issues such as a community, et cetera, but also directly in their language impairment. So mm-hmm. don't feel uncomfortable with recommending treatments way down the road. If it doesn't work individually, then obviously, let me take it back. Certainly, a referral to aphasia centers and aphasia groups, places like Voices of Help, the Aphasia House in Central Florida, the University of Central Florida, programs like that, and I'm sure others in your area, really make a difference. But in addition to that, don't be scared to try individual therapy as well. So that's kind of like a
and I agree with you. I think
to that question.
Yep. No, I think that I was listening to a webinar last night, in fact, of a program, Constant Therapy, and I interviewed Dr. Swathi Kran last year, which is an app that can be used by patients. And I think that change, again, via technology of being able to really put the power of treatment, if you will, in patients' hands so that they, if they remain motivated and choose to continue to work on any aspect of their communication, that they can continue to do that. So in addition to maybe a change in I guess perspective, how we view or work with individuals that have chronic problems, kind of outside of that acute care model. What would you say are a few of the other significant changes, Dr. Hahn, that you have seen in how we approach aphasia rehabilitation or treatment?
Well, one of the ones that I'm really, it's really just beginning, but I'm really excited about it, and that is I think we are finally getting the message that it would be really wise to work on language that people might possibly use when they talk, and
yeah.
that, to use Becky Kyan's words, the development of personally relevant stimuli for the straightforward treatment of the impairment of aphasia is a remarkable development, and I think it's one that is really going to start to show its effects. So I think that's a really important one. You mentioned another one, and that is the sometimes you can really use the word plethora, the plethora of really nice apps that are
right.
available for people with aphasia, with mild cognitive impairments across the board, with a lot of that can aid in everyday communication as well as to provide practice. And I think that to me is one of the really exciting trends. I don't think I've been in this business for a long time, and I'm pretty sure if anybody asked me if I'd be saying this at this point in my life, I think I would be laughing. I just never saw this coming, and I think it's extremely exciting. And another one that I sort of alluded to that I think I'd just mention again is that the profession itself is beginning, I think, to realize its role much more specifically in working with neurodegenerative disorders where there is a change. Disorders like primary progressive aphasia, primary progressive apraxia of speech, mild cognitive impairments, and more advanced, not only early, but more advanced forms of a variety of dimensions. Those aren't sidelights anymore. They're pretty much, if y'all read the website from C2, that's where the jobs are. And that's where people, can learn to worry and think about changing the atmosphere, not only for people with aphasia through aphasia centers, but changing the atmosphere and the and how people, even long past as they end up in assisted living or longer-term units, where those aren't sidelights anymore. And this is going to be, I think, something that our profession has got to start preparing people for in a very different way. And I think that has a ripple effect all through the whole world of neurodegenerative disorders, but also the world of aphasia, which is not one of those disorders. Long answer.
I would add to that that I think a tremendous amount of education, and it's going to have to come from us and consumers, needs to be towards the payers. Again, I can just tell you recently, having seen someone came to me actually via a workman's comp, an injury, but with post-TBI, and not only is speech-language therapy, not even normally a part of this referring network's therapies, but it really took months for the referral to even occur because they just didn't understand the impact of a cognitive linguistic impairment. So I think there's a great need for education there as well. Jackie, you had on your website on Voices of Hope for Aphasia an interesting statistic or finding of a study I want to ask you about, and that was you noted the number of people in the state of Florida with aphasia. Quite high. I think it was 200,000 Floridians with aphasia, but then reported that in a survey that had been conducted, only 10% of the persons surveyed knew what aphasia even was. And I'm just wondering if you could talk about, was that a survey you conducted, your center?
Well, first I should say that the idea of surveying people about their knowledge of aphasia, really the great work that was done by Chris Code and Roberta Elliman and Nina Simmons-Mackey and others was surveying people at various locations in English-speaking countries. So this was Australia and a few sites in the United States and the United Kingdom. And so they went to shopping malls and other places and, you know, surveyed a group of people. And so the average across all those sites and across those countries is roughly about 10% of people being able to correctly define the word aphasia and have some knowledge about aphasia. So that's the starting point. Now, what we have done in our area, immediate area, is to informally follow that up. So we have used the same survey questions at various events that we have attended, whether it be health fairs, other community events, and so we've started to collect all of our responses, and so we have a rough idea of the knowledge of the word aphasia in our immediate area, and it's not too surprising that it's roughly the same as what was reported by the other groups that had originally done the survey. So that's the story of the survey. One thing we are finding, though, is that we have a bit of a higher percentage of people knowing the word aphasia among those who attend health fairs. So that's not really too surprising in a way. If you select to attend a health fair, then you probably are paying more attention to health issues and health information. But we do find a lot more people in our area who come to health fairs actually seem to know about aphasia a little bit more. So that's kind of interesting. And perhaps that means that at least among those who are paying attention to health issues, they're hearing the word and they're having a little more basic information about aphasia.
I also read this on your website and somewhere, but if not, forgive me. and that was about individuals leaving the hospital, acute care, which particularly nowadays happens pretty quickly if they have no significant motor impairment following a stroke, without a lot of knowledge themselves, the patients or families, about aphasia or direction to community services. And again, I know I certainly have seen a few people, even in this last year, who had a brief hospital stay with post-CVA, but with no motor impairment, but with residual language problems, that again, because of that quick discharge, really had very little information. And just wondering, again, your observations there.
Yes, I have had the same experience, Mary, as you, that people often report that, you know, they didn't hear anything about aphasia, they weren't given information, or they didn't know what to do. And it's hard to know whether they were given some information and in the trauma and the stress of being in hospital didn't really process that information in a way that they could act on it later, or if in fact they never received the information.
Mm-hmm.
I do think we do have, you know, some studies, a couple of studies have suggested that when people in the acute care situation after stroke are only informally evaluated or screened for language impairments or cognitive impairments for that matter, it's very likely that any kind of mild or maybe even moderate cognitive and language issue could easily be overlooked. So in other words, if the speech pathologist or any other clinician is kind of just making a determination about aphasia or other cognitive linguistic issues based on an informal conversation, that increases the chances that an aphasia or something else could be missed, and therefore the person would not be diagnosed with it and not be referred for appropriate services. So that's one thing that can happen in acute care. And I do think this is why, I think two things about acute care. It seems very critical that at least some sort of a formal screening be administered to people to try to catch any language or other cognitive linguistic issue so that they can be referred to the appropriate services later. I also think that we have a big responsibility now as speech pathologists to try to provide ways, you know, more effective ways for the person, the patient with aphasia, to communicate with the staff in the hospital and also to receive appropriate information. I mean, Linda Worrell and others have done some beautiful work showing the importance of receiving aphasia-friendly written information about stroke and also about aphasia. And this should be on the horizon for us, that we should be taking a much more active role in hospitals and in acute care to be the ones who train other hospital staff and clinicians and broker that so that people with aphasia can have accessible information by the time they leave acute care, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 days after they've been admitted.
Yeah, of course, that is easily a subject for a whole other podcast.
Right.
And I don't even want to take us too deep there, but I feel so passionate about it again, always have, and probably even just heightened to the nth degree when I had a personal experience of that. Again, I can say my mom in a well-respected hospital. I happened to be up there visiting because she had been in the hospital for several weeks before she had the stroke, and I had just left. And when I got a call that they thought that's what had happened, by the time I got back, she was outside the CT room, completely aphasic, really looking like a deer in the headlights. And me, of course, realizing what for me was one of the worst horrors to imagine, a parent now, unable to speak, but I left then because I had to, but in fact went to a conference and grabbed a picture communication board from one of the vendors because I was heading back to visit my mom, and so now it was about maybe a 4 or 5 day interim, and was hearing from my family that she was understanding, and went back with this communication board and quickly could see that she was understanding and could access it. But again, much to my dismay, this was, you know, 5 days into post-stroke, and although she had had PT and OT, had not had any options for communication. And so I can't agree with you enough, Jackie, about how much speech-language pathologists must continue to educate other healthcare professionals about the importance of our role and meeting those needs.
If I may add something, Mary, too.
Yes.
Having worked in acute care, I'm also very sympathetic to the tensions and the time constraints of being in that setting as a speech pathologist. And so one thing that we're doing at Voices of Hope for Aphasia is trying to bridge that gap. And we offer a 2-day workshop called I Have Aphasia, Now What? And we ask hospitals and rehab facilities in our area to host us, and they do. And so they bring us into their hospital and refer their patients. And this gives their patients and their families an opportunity to have more in-depth time to understand what is aphasia and what is going to happen and what they can do in a way that the hospital-based speech pathologists, realistically, with all the policy constraints and everything else, they don't have time to do it. So we partner with them to try to bridge the gap about and foster family education, patient-centered education, and also transition to the community.
Yeah, that's a great,
really exciting,
great.
Jackie. That's really
yeah,
neat.
What a great resource, and again, maybe a model for other community-based programs. So, Jackie, go ahead and let's stay on Voices of Hope for Aphasia. Tell listeners about that program. I know
Voices of Hope
was founded by a patient.
Founded by a patient. It was founded by Mike Caputo, who had a stroke when he was about 50 years old, and his wife, Kathy. And during his rehab, he was very fortunate to have a lot of family support, and he also attended the Adler Aphasia Center, another important aphasia center program in our country, which also was founded by somebody with aphasia and his wife. So Mike and Kathy Caputo, as they came down to Florida, wanted to facilitate something, some kind of programming like that, because they recognized how critical it was for people with aphasia to continue to have social support. And it's not just the social, the social support and the social interaction does more than just make you feel good, although if that's all it did, that would be great. But it actually does more. And Audrey was talking about this a little bit earlier, too, because we know that people who continue to stay active, who continue to challenge themselves, who have things to say, who want to try to say things, that facilitates a continued improvement over the long term. And so Audrey was mentioning that, you know, they showed that in the aphasia talk bank data. Mm-hmm. And we certainly observe it in our members. And I think, you know, every aphasia program or center that I know about observes this, that staying active and staying engaged is, first of all, makes you feel good, but also helps your speech and language improve. So
not only that,
that's very important.
It keeps you younger. It keeps your mind active, and you are saying, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a whole lot of reason to suspect that there's nothing about aphasia that protects you from the normal effects of aging. And those are all things that sort of are neuroprotective for maintaining as excellent mental and physical health as you possibly can. Those are all pieces of stuff that everybody who is aging should be doing, and there's no reason why aphasic people should not be doing them. I just need to break in here for a minute. I've had the total pleasure of visiting the majority of the major aphasia centers in the country as a function of my work with Aphasia Bank. And the spirit, and if you have never been to an aphasia center, get me to an aphasia center just to pick up the vibe. It is really, really a wonderful experience, and it'll make you much more optimistic about your own professional lives.
I think also, Jackie, as you said, you know, while obviously social interaction is an important component, but you can't do communication. You can't communicate in isolation either. So it's really a necessary piece of continuing to improve communication for someone with aphasia. Dr. Holland, I think another component of interaction with patients for speech language pathologists certainly is the counseling piece. I think it is for us, I think working with persons with any, again, chronic neurodegenerative disorder or any chronic communication problem, and I think it constitutes in many ways, whether we consciously realize it or not, a lot of what we are doing with patients and their families. But it's also, I think, not an area that probably many SLPs get a lot of training in. We may have a class, maybe a course in counseling. I know, again, it's something of interest to you, more than interest. You've written about this. Was that your interest in sort of the counseling piece, just a natural outgrowth of your years of working as a speech-language pathologist, or how did you come to begin writing about that?
Not at all. I was lucky enough to be trained in a program that had counseling as a major piece of the training, so it's sort of been with me, you know, since I was teething in this field. Mm-hmm. But first of all, you know, it has to be recognized that counseling is within the scope of practice, and I think that's mm-hmm. one of the things that is relatively misunderstood by a number of clinicians. And I think it's important across the spectrum, but I think of language disorders. But I think in adults, it's probably most important with people who have language disorders. And from my perspective, counseling is basically how we educate families and provide training in things like supported communication, learning to listen mm-hmm. to family needs as well as patient needs. Now, of course, the people with aphasia who actually live in the problem are major recipients are major people who require some counseling. They have tons of needs, ranging in my view from helping them take responsibility for their own recovery, to recognize what works best for them and to insist upon having it, all the way down to learning new tricks like how to use tablets and apps. And all mm-hmm. of these things, to me, are part of the counseling process, the counseling piece of our profession. Of course, the bottom line is the most important counseling skill of all is listening, and listening to what our clients have to say, and that's all in addition to learning new things and managing a different identity, perhaps getting on with life, developing resilience, and so forth and so on. But listening doesn't require a formal course. It requires catching your breath, thinking about it, centering, looking like you're listening, and giving patients and their families, the PAs and their families, time to respond and to think about it and know that you are interested in the bigger picture of life with aphasia. That's all counseling to me.
How do people find out about your program, Jackie? I mean, I know you've already mentioned a little bit the outreach that you do. And are you only right now serving people in St. Pete in that area? Are you trying to help people in other places sort of start similar programs? Or what's the kind of the mission of your organization?
Well, in addition to the two-day workshop that I mentioned, that we offer at area hospitals and rehab facilities, we offer a two-day-a-week program for people with aphasia, and we also have a very active aphasia caregiver program. So those are our three main programs, and people hear about us, first of all, from professionals in the area, and I think having the two-day workshop where we go to different hospitals is giving many of the clinicians in our area an opportunity to learn about us and learn what we do in a way that, you know, they can run down during lunch and at least catch a little bit of the workshop or something like that in a way that they wouldn't otherwise get to do. So that's helping us to have people refer people to us. But, you know, that's usually so people might get referred because they're in therapy now and they're going to maybe end therapy, or this is an adjunct to therapy to our programs. But then, you know, there are people out there who are no longer receiving specialized rehabilitation services, and they may just be sitting at home. And I think it's a trick to figure out good ways of trying to get information to those folks. But we do everything that we can do in terms of getting information out to the local media and online, and in those ways hope that we get to some of those people as well. At the moment, we provide our day program primarily in Pinellas County, and we have a model where we are working with community centers and also, for example, the University of South Florida, which hosts us, so that we're able, we'll be expanding locations around Tampa Bay using that model, because many people do have a transportation issue and it's hard to get places. So we need to bring the program to them. So that is an important aspect of what we're trying to accomplish at Voices of Hope.
Are the programs all at no charge to participants? Is there a fee to participate in anything?
We are a nonprofit organization, and the way we handle it is we are able to offer a pay what you can approach to our programs, and so we do request donations for those who can donate. Then they are helping to provide the programming to those who may not be able to financially contribute, but we make sure that people can participate regardless of whether they're able to financially contribute or not.
That's sort of a great pay it forward kind of
yes.
concept. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that's great. I know, Dr. Holland, you are going to be participating in a two-day workshop, seminar, conference that will be sponsored by Voices of Hope this fall. And you're going to be talking about counseling issues, correct? I think so.
Probably going to be talking about lots of things.
And I saw somewhere, I don't think it was in their brochure, but somewhere in maybe your bio, about a training you had done, which sounded awfully interesting to me, called Authentic Happiness. What is that?
It's actually positive psychology, and it's actually a development in an aspect of the general field of psychology. And Martin Seligman at University of Pennsylvania is the primary igniter of this interest in not what's wrong with people, as in abnormal psychology, but look at what's right with people, which is easily as important. And I think it forms a really interesting, I think that fits with the kinds of counseling that we should be doing. And that's how I got interested in positive psychology in the first place. A lot of it is summarized in his book, his first book, which is called Authentic Happiness. But the point of view is to build on what people are. It's a strengths-based look at counseling, and a strengths-based look at what kinds of things we should be fostering, go after what people do best. And that's kind of my approach to, largely my approach to counseling.
There's not much I like about aging, but I do wonder sometimes if maybe a positive aspect of aging, literally chronologically, but just in life, is as a clinician, again, I know that I'm so much of that ilk anymore. I think as a young clinician, you are focused on the impairments, kind of what you've just come out of school learning. But with time and age and experience, and I find, at least for myself, I really want to find quickly and embrace what's working, what's right, and focus on that. It seems a much more empowering way to deliver treatment. And again, in aphasia rehabilitation, when we talk about neuroplasticity, even at a physiologic level, that is really the whole goal, isn't it, to take what's working and use it to bolster some of those areas that have been injured.
Right.
Jackie, any comments?
Go ahead.
No, go on.
Taking what is, if we focus on what's working, then that is going to build up everything about the person. And I think that's one thing that even though we want to think about the person in a holistic way, many times it's the way our policies and documentation and things are in certain of our practice settings, it's easy to drop that view of the whole person sometimes. We don't mean to, but we get swamped with our paperwork and everything else. Mm-hmm. And so the person, you know, who has gone through the hospital and is now trying to figure out how to put their life back together and how to move on, is, you know, really needs to think about what can they do. And so I think putting that patient-centered emphasis, holistic view in our speech therapy practice, and then partnering, you know, coupling that with a positive psychology approach in counseling is extremely powerful. And I know that many of us have been influenced by Audrey's work in positive psychology and bringing that into counseling practices and speech pathology. And that's why we are so thrilled and overjoyed to have her at our fall conference.
So tell us about that conference.
About coming.
So
Jackie, give us your website. Go ahead and give your website address. And
sure. Our website is voices, H as in hope, aphasia.org. That's VOHaphasia.org. And we're very proud of a brand new video that we recently posted on our homepage, and I hope you'll all check it out because it tells a lot about the social interaction and the relationships and the meaningfulness that comes from aphasia programs like ours. But we also invite people with aphasia and their families and speech pathologists to all attend our conference this fall. It's September 30th and October 1st. That's a Friday and a Saturday. Speech pathologists will have a track and where they will not only listen to Audrey, but they're going to have a special session where they get to ask her almost anything, and I'm personally really looking forward to that.
I am too.
And and earn at their ASHA CEU, so that'll be covered. But we also have a track specifically designed for people with aphasia and their families with special breakout sessions for caregivers. And I think besides, it's not just that we have these two tracks going on in parallel, but what I'm really excited about this year is that we took an even bigger step into crafting interactive experiences around the table discussions between the professionals and the people living with aphasia. And I'm really so excited about this because many times in speech pathologists, they don't really get to know what happens to people once they're discharged. And so how much can you learn when you sit down at a table and chat about some guided topics and things like that? So this is going to be a great experience, I'm sure, for everyone, and I'm just thrilled about it.
Yeah, great. So give that web address one more time.
The web address is vohaphasia.org, and on the top of the homepage you will see a tab that says conference. And if you go to that tab, you will be able to register directly, make hotel reservations. The conference will be held in the St. Pete, Clearwater area in Florida, and see the whole schedule and the speakers and everything. So please check it out. And early bird registration for speech pathologists is still available, so check it out.
That's great. Thank you. I think that your program and programs like yours must really be a real lifeline for people who also live alone. I mean, I can't help but think just my own mom had so many supports around her and how important that was to her psychological recovery and physical recovery. But for persons who don't have that, to be able to access support and friendship and the opportunity to continue to improve their communication skills would seem to me to be another really important aspect of your program. So before we run out of time, because we're going to, in a couple of minutes, Dr. Holland, give us a few words of wisdom here. No pressure.
You sort of got me interested when you raised the issue of aging. And since I suspect, and aging, you're right, is not for sissies. And I suspect that a lot of people who are listening into this website are probably a lot younger than, certainly all of them are younger than me, but of Mary and Jackie as well. And I sort of think it's important to understand that people who are older than you who have aphasia still have a lot going for them. They have experience. They have all sorts of practical knowledge. and they have the wisdom that comes simply from living life. And I would remind you that although respect is very, very important for every client we work with, this is the group that probably has most clearly earned the right to your respect. So begin your relationship with them by making this totally and completely obvious and transparent that you are respectful. And my guess is one of the best ways you can do that is to ask them by what name they would like to be called. I'm still doing this at my advanced age. I'm saying, do you want to be called by your first name, or do you want to be called Mr. Smith or whatever? So it's just a little bitty thing, but they're not going to respect your certificate of clinical competence nearly as much as they're going to respect your treating them with the respect they deserve. So that's my comment today.
Thank you. So before we run out of time here, we got about 3 minutes left. I do want to mention that on the Voices of Hope website, so I encourage listeners to peruse that website, there was some interesting information about voting the importance of voting for people with aphasia or any communication disorders. I can see I'm going to be seizing this as some real soapbox soon, but it really made me think about how many people might be disenfranchised by their inability to communicate or manipulate some aspect of the stylus or whatever. So they have some really good information on their website about that, and I really invite you to read it. It may not have complete relevance for people in states outside of Florida, but nevertheless, I think it will bring to all of our consciousness the importance, particularly this year in this election, where we're all listening, I am at least, carefully to the language of our candidates. That those who have difficulty communicating have the opportunity to exercise that right. It's a pretty darn important one. All right, so I guess I've had the last word. We are almost out of time, so I do want to thank my guests, Dr. Jackie Hinckley and the esteemed Dr. Audrey Holland. Thank you for tuning in. Watch your email for the next announcement or the next episode of Voice Aerobics Talking to You. There will not be a podcast in July because I'll be taking a little much-needed vacation. Today's show, however, will be archived, and you can listen to it again on Blog Talk Radio, where there's a link directly from my website, or you can listen to it on iTunes. Again, just go to Voice Aerobics Talking to You, also a link on my website. I hope that you will visit my website, www.voiceaerobicsdvd.com, learn about some of the programs and the products that I offer, which are designed to support voice use. You can also find a link there to my blog, also learn a little bit about online coaching, and hopefully also see the reflection of my mission, which is to enlist individuals in their treatment, to help them express their personality and spirit through voice, to educate and empower. Thank you so much, Dr. Holland and Dr. Hinckley, and to everyone else. Have a great day. Thank you both. Hope to see you in the fall.